This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 3rd. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A defiant Milosevic refuses to enter a plea branding the UN War Tribunal in The Hague a cover-up. President Bush hands Governor Bush a victory and scales back oil drilling off the coast of Florida. And Tampa police have a new weapon in their war against crime, cameras that photograph crowds and any criminals in the midst. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is being investigated by a Belgian court for crimes against humanity. Rupert Cook has more from Europe.
The Belgian Public Prosecutor's Office announced Monday that a Belgian judge has opened an investigation of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for alleged crimes against humanity in a 1982 massacre of Palestinians. Judge Patrick Collignon began the investigation following two complaints filed against Sharon over the killing of hundreds of Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon. The complaints, which also accuse Sharon of genocide and war crimes, were filed under a 1993 law allowing Belgian courts to prosecute foreigners for human rights violations committed outside Belgium. Lebanese and Palestinian survivors of the massacre brought the complaints. The first stage is the judge's investigation. This will determine whether there is enough evidence to press charges with a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. A 1983 Israeli state inquiry found Sharon, then the defense minister, indirectly responsible for the killing of hundreds of men, women, and children at the camps during Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Israeli soldiers allowed Israeli-backed Christian phalangist militiamen to enter the camps, ostensibly to search for Palestinian gunmen after the assassination of phalangist leader Bashir Gemayel, the Lebanese president-elect. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Amsterdam, the Netherlands.
Rather than face a veto by Russia, the UN Security Council will not take up the U.S.-British proposal on sanctions against Iraq. Robert Knight reports.
The United Nations Security Council is expected to vote a five-month extension today of Iraq's oil for food program, just hours before a midnight deadline for renewing the current round of economic sanctions. The action is a setback for the so-called smart sanctions plan proposed by Britain and backed by the United States. That plan purported to ease civilian supplies into Iraq by creating a new list of forbidden military or dual-use items. The measure was grudgingly accepted by France and China, but Russia threatened a veto, saying that instead of revising the oil for food program, the United Nations should consider removing sanctions entirely, provided Iraq submits once more to international weapons monitoring. Also at issue were Anglo-American efforts to cut off Iraq's black market oil sales to Western allies like Turkey and Jordan, whose protests were a factor in defeating the proposal, which will be revised, reintroduced, and debated further by the Security Council in the coming months. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Free Speech Radio News.
The New York State Court of Appeals has ruled that a medical school policy of letting married couples, not same-sex partners, share college housing may violate anti-discrimination laws. Jeff Brady reports from New York.
New York's highest court has ruled that two lesbian students should be allowed to sue for a biased policy that excludes same-sex couples from university housing. Yeshiva University is a Jewish religious school that, among other things, trains rabbis. Legal experts say they can sue under the city's human rights law that protects gays, minorities, and other racial discrimination in housing and employment. The two women filed suit, claiming the university's policy had a disparate impact on gays and lesbians. A lower court dismissed the suit, reasoning that the policy had impacted unmarried heterosexuals as well. But the Court of Appeals returned the case to the lower court, saying the policy would constitute discrimination if the effect was greater on homosexual couples. The lawsuit is being pursued by the American Civil Liberties Union and other anti-discrimination groups. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
And finally, China's Communist Party could be ready to receive capitalists. That from China's Secretary General Jiang Zemin commemorating the 80th anniversary of the Communist Party in China. As China struggles towards becoming a member of the World Trade Organization, its private business sector is growing. China's state-run factories are floundering while newer businesses are being expanded, although slowly. The world's largest communist party is having a hard time because of the move away from Marxism and towards a socialist-capitalist hybrid culture. Others worry that allowing private businessmen into the party could lead to factionalism in an already ideologically shaky system. In the meantime, China won major support yesterday from the United States in its bid to become part of the WTO. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Facing his prosecutors alone, Slobodan Milosevic refused to enter a plea of war crimes charges today, branding the UN tribunal illegal and saying his trial was aimed at covering up NATO crimes in Yugoslavia. Chief Judge Richard May, who repeatedly admonished the former Yugoslav president that the proceedings were not the time to make speeches, entered a plea of innocent on Milosevic's behalf. The four charges against Milosevic relate to crimes against humanity and other offenses committed by his forces in Kosovo during the 1998-1999 crackdown on ethnic Albanians. Generally controlled, but with flashes of defiance, Milosevic, who wore a slate-blue suit, light-blue shirt and tie, appeared calm during the 12-minute arraignment. However, the two security guards who flanked him had to nudge the ex-president to stand when the three judges entered the room. With more on the unfolding Milosevic war crimes tribunal, Geraldine Coughlin reports from The Hague.
Slobodan Milosevic was scornful of the court formalities conducted by the British judge Richard May.
I have no need to appoint counsel to illegal organ.
Mr. Milosevic, in due course, you will have the chance to put in motions challenging the jurisdiction or any other preliminary matter which you wish to do.
When the judge told Milosevic he should reconsider his choice to defend himself, he dismissed the tribunal as an illegal institution.
I consider this tribunal a false tribunal and indictments false indictments. It is illegal, being not appointed by UN General Assembly, so I have no need to appoint counsel to illegal organ.
When the judge asked the former president if he was ready to enter a plea, he tried to make a political speech. The judge then ruled that the court will enter a plea of not guilty on his behalf. The prosecution now starts to prepare its case. Tribunal spokesman Jim Landale said Milosevic's uncooperative stance won't influence the legal proceedings.
No, the process goes on. It doesn't cause any problems whatsoever. We will be advising Mr. Milosevic when we can that he should be legally represented. He would be in a far better situation to have expert legal advice for his defence.
If he doesn't want, what's the court happen?
If he doesn't want, he's entitled to defend himself.
The crux of the case now is that the prosecution must prove Milosevic's command responsibility for the alleged crimes of murder, persecution, and the deportation of 740,000 ethnic Albanians. It may be hard to follow a paper trail of evidence to place Milosevic at the top of the chain of command, but Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch thinks the former president will have a tough case to answer in terms of his accountability.
I'm not privy to the evidence here, but certainly the facts that Human Rights Watch gathered on the ground suggest a pattern of atrocity that suggests on the facts a very overwhelming picture that one can only imagine Mr. Milosevic was aware of but failed to take action to prevent.
One gripe that Slobodan Milosevic has with the tribunal is that no ethnic Albanians have been charged with war crimes committed in Kosovo. The UN Refugee Agency says 240,000 minorities, most of them Serb, have fled Kosovo since NATO bombing ended 2 years ago. But court officials say they're investigating this and that they're monitoring the current armed conflict involving ethnic Albanians in Macedonia. They've pledged to issue indictments if they can gather enough evidence to do so. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Geraldine Coughlin in The Hague.
The Bush administration sharply scaled back its plans today to drill for oil and natural gas in the Gulf of Mexico, trying to defuse an issue that has pitted President Bush against his brother, Governor Jeb Bush of Florida. But Gail Norton, the Secretary of the Interior, said the administration would still seek to let oil companies drill on about 1.5 million acres in the Gulf, a quarter of the roughly 6 million acres that the Clinton administration first proposed opening for leasing in 1997. The compromise plan retreats from Mr. Bush's national energy strategy released in May, which argued that urgent steps were needed to find more domestic energy sources, including in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. It hands a clear victory to Governor Jeb Bush, who, along with Florida's influential congressional delegation, opposed any drilling that might threaten the state's beaches. Administration officials acknowledged that the decision reflected the president's efforts to find a way out of a political quandary that involved family ties, splits in the Republican Party, and attacks by environmentalists on Mr. Bush's energy policies. With more on the story, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Gareth Schweitzer files this report.
The Bush administration announced yesterday that 1.5 million acres of the eastern Gulf of Mexico will be open to new leases for oil and gas drilling. An earlier proposal that suggested 6 million acres for new leases ran into serious opposition in the state of Florida from both legislators and environmental groups. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer claimed that the new plan is the result of an open-minded and environmentally friendly administration.
The president has heard the voices of people of Florida, and he has done just what he said he'd do, which is work with the governors of all the states on the Gulf of Mexico and come out with a plan that is environmentally sensitive and balanced.
Florida Governor Jeb Bush, the president's brother, was only one of Florida's political figures that lobbied the president against such expansive drilling. While the new proposal incorporates far less sea area and moves new rigs farther from the coastline, it is not the environmentally conscious plan the administration says it is, according to Joe Murphy, a spokesman for the Sierra Club in Florida.
Any increased drilling or leasing in that section of the Gulf, in the eastern portion of the Gulf of Mexico, is a direct threat to Florida's environment and Florida's economy and to our fisheries, and it represents a great example of the Bush administration's flawed energy proposal or plan that puts more focus on extraction and fossil fuels than it does on clean technologies and renewables.
By moving potential new rigs farther from shore, the new leasing plan allows the president to avoid angering either his brother or a bipartisan group of Florida legislators who opposed the initial drilling plan. Environmentalists, however, remain seriously concerned about the possibly devastating effects of an oil rig accident.
Offshore drilling is a dirty business, and there's no way around it. And you have to look at offshore drilling from the beginning point to the end point. The first thing they do is they drill exploratory wells. In that process, there's the potential for some sort of spill. Then they put in a production well, a much bigger facility. That production well means a lot of point source pollution into the area waters. They use heavy metals in the drilling muds. There's a lot of pollution from the rigs. Then they have to transport that material that they drilled for, and in oil in particular, this is dangerous, through either pipelines or tankers to onshore processing facilities.
In Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
Tampa, Florida has become the first city in America to employ a computer software program that uses existing police surveillance cameras to scan crowds and recognize the faces of wanted criminals. The technology was first introduced during last January's Super Bowl, where it spotted 19 people with outstanding warrants. Now the technology is being used in Ybor City, a popular nightclub district where thousands of people congregate on the weekend. The system is drawing the wrath of civil libertarians who believe it is the next step in the public completely losing any sense of privacy. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
Video cameras in Ybor City are not new. They were installed in the district 4 years ago and work just like surveillance cameras do in thousands of ATMs, 7-Elevens, and banks around the world. What is new is the technology, a software program called FaceIt, which can instantly capture the images of up to four people in one frame. Francis Zelazny is communications spokesperson for the New Jersey-based Visionics Corporation, the software developer.
The features are actually landmarks on the face that are closely associated with the bone structure. So they're like your cheekbones, your eye sockets, the tip of your nose, the bridge of your nose, your jawline, your chin, basically the peaks and valleys associated with the bone structure.
And Zelazny says the technology reads different parts of a human face, therefore ensuring that disguises will not be sufficient to avoid recognition.
There are 80 of these points on the face, and we only require 14 to 22 to do the recognition. So if you grow a beard or put on glasses or put on a hat or whatnot, that's still not going to affect it because we can. It's not always the same 14 to 22 points that we need.
Those facial images will then be instantly compared to a database that can ultimately hold up to 30,000 images. Tampa Police Detective Bill Todd.
First of all, in the database, we have missing children, runaways. Then we have wanted felons and sexual predators under court supervision.
Civil libertarians are outraged by this new technology. Florida ACLU head Howard Simon says that if the FASIC technology is allowed to be used, it will only add to the complete surveillance of the American public.
If we're going to protect rights in the society, if we're going to save anything that is a remnant of privacy in the society, we better insist that if the police want to stop us, want to capture our image, want to ask for ID, want to run our image through a database, the police have to have a reason to do that.
Shop owners in Ybor City, perhaps predictably, like the manager of a novelty store called Sidekicks on 7th, embrace the surveillance program.
I think it's a very good thing. I think that Ybor City is growing. We have a large population of tourists that come in, and it's necessary to have extra security, especially for the weekends when it's really busy and crowded, and a lot of the stores experience theft. So it's good to have a second eye out there watching the sidewalks.
But perhaps more surprisingly, a random sampling of others in the area on a Monday afternoon also indicated mostly support for the surveillance cameras and its technology.
I think it's pretty good. I think that it's got a good cause.
I think it's all right. I mean, because, you know, it's anything that can help the safety of the people, you know.
Where it's at, you know, if it's like in the bathroom or something like that, I wouldn't want that. But I guess it's all right in the streets because, you know, there's a lot of crime over here. And so it'll cut back a little bit.
Tampa police say another possibility for the FASIT software could be to incorporate gang members with prior convictions. Mabili Ajani hosts a weekly radio program highlighting inequities and social justice in the Tampa Bay area.
We already know that it's just one more tool towards discrimination, and people who have committed crimes in the past will always be dogged by whatever record is left of this technology. And if you're black in this society, you're a black man who started out as a criminal because of life's socioeconomic situations, and you're trying to change your life, this record is always there to dog you and always keep you in some kind of lockdown situation, no matter, you know, where you are in the society. And we have to remember, Florida is a southern state. Tampa was not immune to the same racism throughout this century that any other southern city was.
Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Negotiations for the expansion of the European Union into Eastern Europe are progressing rapidly. Despite numerous setbacks, the objective of the European Union is that candidate countries will be full members by 2004. But as Patrick Beckett reports from Salzburg, Austria, these countries may not gain all the rights of Western European nations for many years.
For much of our shared history, Europe has been at war with itself. In 1957, at the Treaty of Rome, a new idea took shape. The European Economic Community.
The theme of this weekend's economic forum in Salzburg is Europe, Building on Diversity. It is the first year the forum has included all of Europe, both Western and Eastern Bloc countries.
We look forward to continuing to build Europe together.
There are 664 participants from 42 countries at the summit, including 12 heads of state or prime ministers and 13 ministers. The occasion for the meeting is the rapid progress towards admitting Eastern European countries into the European Union. 2 weeks ago, at the European Union summit in Gothenburg, Sweden, European Commission President Romano Prodi expressed the inevitability of European enlargement.
We agreed here to maintain and strengthen our commitments on enlargement. The enlargement process is irreversible, and there is no going back now. There is no going back. We expect to complete negotiation by the end of 2002 with the country that will be ready. Our objective, as you know, is that new member states will participate as full members in the European Parliament election of 2004.
There are 13 candidate countries whose governments are seeking entry into the EU. These include Bulgaria, Cyprus, the Czech Republic, Estonia, and Hungary. Also Latvia, Lithuania, Malta, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Turkey. Despite the firm commitment by politicians and business leaders to move ahead with enlargement, the process faces numerous setbacks. The many criteria which must be met by Eastern European governments to gain admittance have raised the hackles of politicians and the people of the candidate countries. Many of these people feel decisions regarding EU expansion are being made without their approval. Miloslav Ransdorf is a member of the Chamber of Deputies in the Czech Parliament. He came to Salzburg this weekend to take part in the counter-summit held by demonstration organizers.
I'm convinced that this integration cannot be only the case of harmonization of our legislative norms. It cannot be only the case of politicians or government or parliamentarian bodies, but it should be the case of all people, and the poor people should be informed in full scope about advantages and disadvantages of the membership in the European Union.
Poland's president, Aleksander Kwasniewski, said in Salzburg this weekend that Europe is beset by a paradox. While Eastern Europe is rapidly moving towards economic integration with the rest of the continent, these developments are not being welcomed by the public. One impasse in the negotiations is a 7-year transition period imposed on new member countries. During this time, workers from Eastern Europe would be unable to migrate to Western countries, while labor from the West will be allowed to move east. At the forum in Salzburg this weekend, Slovenia's Prime Minister Janez Drnovšek rejected this policy. He believes Slovenia will quickly become a net receiver of labor migration from the EU. Western European countries also worry about the potential for a flood of immigrants from the East. Opponents of EU expansion encompass both right and left-wing political proponents. But at the grassroots level, people are concerned about working conditions in both the East and the West. In Salzburg, Miloslav Ransdorf warns the rapid expansion of the EU will result in numerous problems.
The potential of Czech economy is large enough to enable it. But if we let things go spontaneously, without, we can say, clearly debated framework, so it can result in social tensions, in decay of social standards, and in upheaval. And it is something not desired.
In the WEF summit this weekend, participants are striving to achieve just such rapid enlargement of the EU, which Ransdorf is concerned about. From the Austrian Independent Media Center in Salzburg, this is Patrick Beckett, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
While world attention has been focused on the conflict between indigenous Zapatistas and the Mexican government in Chiapas State, ecological issues have been increasingly coming to the foreground as well. One major issue is the ongoing deforestation of Chiapas's Lacandon rainforest. Kent Patterson recently interviewed a leading researcher of the issue. He files this report.
In the southern state of Chiapas, the world's attention has been focused on the conflict between the Mexican government and the Zapatista indigenous movement. But some of the roots of this conflict can be traced to the crisis in the Lacandon rainforest, one of the last remaining such ecosystems in North America. Neil Harvey is professor of government at New Mexico State University. He's a longtime visitor to Chiapas and the author of Chiapas, The Struggle for Land and Democracy.
And so this has attracted a lot of international attention from governments, particularly in the last decade, in terms of the need to conserve rainforests because of the function that they serve in the global ecosystem, in reducing global warming. So there's a lot of pressure from some governments and from environmental organizations in the developed countries for the Mexican government to declare areas as natural reserves. But this creates another problem because people are already living in the area, and there's been a conflict recently where the Mexican government has tried to remove indigenous communities that have settled in the Lacandon rainforest over the years with this argument that they are not helping to conserve the rainforest. However, the greatest culprits of the depletion tend to be the larger, wealthier families of ranchers and loggers, and they've been able to operate more freely.
Besides agriculture, Harvey says commercial logging, much of it illegal, has likewise played a role in deforestation. One especially impacted species has been mahogany, a wood product used to make fine furniture. A recent report by the World Wildlife Fund blames U.S. consumer demand for mahogany as contributing to the depletion of the resource throughout Latin America. Professor Harvey says that in Mexico and Central America, mahogany and other tropical species are the choice commodities of a clandestine business.
Timber was being cut on the Mexican side in this region known as Marques de Comillas, which is a sub-region of the Lacandon rainforest in Chiapas. Now, that couldn't be legally sold within Mexico. It had to have permits from the different communities where it was cut. So instead, what people were doing was taking the timber over into Guatemala and then re-importing it into Mexico, claiming this was timber from Guatemala. And some people did well off that, but the forest didn't. In 1994, 1995, permits were actually given in this region for the exploitation of about 2,000 trees of mahogany on the condition of certain practices of reforestation. About 17,000 were cut in that same period, so they went way beyond the limit. And since then, there's been, again, attempts, some a little more successful, to control the illegal trade. But there are many interests at stake, including the wealthy caciques or rural bosses that control politics in the region. And the military itself has been implicated in it because it's a region full of military checkpoints, and it's kind of curious how Zapatistas can be stopped at checkpoints, but illegal logs cannot.
Professor Harvey says one response by the Mexican government has been to deploy the military in forest conservation work.
And in many cases, the construction of roads to increase the military presence has destroyed as much forest as is being reforested. And they also believe that this function of the military now to be the people who are going to reforest the rainforest of Chiapas is simply a pretext to have greater military presence because of the conflict in the region, and to be able to have greater surveillance over what's happening, but with a very green, environmentally sound face.
Under the new administration of President Vicente Fox, soldiers are reportedly being used in other parts of Mexico to combat illegal timber harvesting. According to recent press reports, a militarized police unit, the Federal Preventive Police, has been deployed in raids against outlaw loggers and sawmill operators working closer to Mexico City. While some praise the actions, others, especially human rights advocates, question the implications of the military being used to fight environmental crimes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman. Our technical producer is Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Matt Martin and Ralph Steiner. Our web support comes from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This program was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa, Florida, and the Independent Media Center in New York. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for a special edition of Free Speech Radio News.